Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Susan Czerniak-Spatz died last week at the age of 97. We had the opportunity of having Dr. Czerniak-Spatz on this program several times, but I knew of her before I met her. Dr. Czerniak-Spatz was a survivor of the Holocaust, and generations of Charlotteans, including her students at UNC Charlotte, heard her story of survival, as did audiences around the world. When I finally met Dr. Czerniak-Spatz, I found her to be intelligent, thoughtful, and not at all shy about voicing her opinion. And why should she be? Anyone who survived the Holocaust can hardly be a shrinking violet. It's something she wrote about in her 2005 memoir, Protective Custody, Prisoner 34042. That was the number the Nazis tattooed on her arm, and she was known for rolling up her sleeve to display it as a reminder of man's inhumanity to man. She also used that book to explore the intimate details of her experience leading up to the internment at Auschwitz-Birkenau that she endured, as well as the day-to-day routine of finding a way to survive once inside. She was a young girl then, experiencing and thinking about all the things that young people do. So at times, her book leads to intimate, and I mean intimate, details. It made me wonder at first why she would expose herself in that way. But then again, if you survive Hitler, what is there to fear? Besides, she had a story to tell, and these episodes are part of a story that needs to be told again and again and again, lest we forget. John Cox, who is the director of the Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies at UNC Charlotte, which Dr. Czerniak-Spatz helped found, told the Charlotte Observer she felt even more passionate about retelling her experiences in recent years as she witnessed the rise of the far-right political movements that we have today. When that 2005 book was published, Dr. Susan Czerniak-Spatz joined us in our studio, and we listened back to that riveting conversation this hour. You've been lecturing about the Holocaust, teaching about it. You've been interviewed countless times about it. But I believe, and I could be wrong, that this is the first time that you've written a book about your personal experiences.
That's correct. I mean, up till now, actually, one of the reasons I started writing the book, people have told me for years, why don't you write it down? Do write it down. And I said, it's much more important to me to have the one-on-one experience in classrooms, at lectures, at universities, because people that hear me as a warm body, a live body, mm-hmm. will accept and remember that story. Whereas I know, and I've, when at my time at the university, when I ordered the books for the Holocaust part of the library, there were countless biographies that nobody ever looked at. And you never heard from these people again. And I felt that I did more to remind people or keep that in people's memory if I had on the one-to-one experience. But then I started thinking, in spite of the fact that I do look and bounce, mm-hmm. I'm getting older. And the time might come when I would not be able to go to classrooms, to travel to Europe to lecture, to travel in the country to lecture, and it should be written down. Mm. And that was one of the reasons I finally decided. And as you said, I figured with my life, I don't have to have any secrets. Yeah. What I've lived through, I stand behind, and that's it.
Although you do not look it, and I'm not just saying this because you're sitting in front of me, you are in your 80s.
Of course I am. I wouldn't be here if I would have been any younger.
Well, you're in your 80s, and you were a young girl when this book takes place. Hitler's rise to power was a very long time ago now, and you write about your life in Vienna and in Berlin.
And in Vienna.
And in Prague. Prior
Twice in Vienna.
Right. Yes, exactly. Prior to Hitler's rise to power and during the early days of his rise to power. And then, of course, we go into the concentration camps. But you do this all with a great amount of clarity. And I was reading, and I thought, you know, I'm a lot younger than she is. I don't know if I could write about people that I went to school with, grade school, high school, because I wouldn't remember their names unless I pulled out a yearbook or something. And I wouldn't remember what we did together in our free time. And I wouldn't remember what the house looked like when my parents moved from one place to another. And I just don't know that I would do it. How did you dredge all these memories up with such clarity?
Frankly, I'm beginning to wonder whether that is part of what they call having a long-term memory and getting the short-term memory be a little shorter. It's quite possible, because certain things I do remember that practically I can describe the walkways. I can describe the school across from my grade school in Berlin across from the thing. I don't know why. Some things I suppressed. I don't know whether you remember in the book when I mentioned the effect of the revolt in the crematorium. I suppressed that somehow. I cannot recall that exactly. I was there, right behind when it happened. But I cannot recall details of that. That's gone. But otherwise, somehow or other...
Perhaps that's because that was horrific and this is idyllic?
No, it was not exact. Not everything was idyllic. No, let's say until... It was idyllic until 1938, I guess. Even in Berlin, the last few years, which were somewhat constrained. But, I mean, after 1938, I really became a refugee.
Yeah. Prior to all of this, prior to Hitler's rise to power, you were essentially middle class, but pretty well off.
I would say relatively, because don't forget, in 1929, when I moved, my parents moved to Berlin, I think, in 28, and I came in 29, there was a severe depression, and somehow I think the business of my uncle and my father must have prospered because... Yeah.
It was a greeting card business.
Greeting cards wholesale. Wholesale greeting card business. Don't forget, at that time, they still sent Easter cards and Christmas cards, and the company made the covers for candy boxes, these large covers, fancy covers for candy boxes, and they made... table cards, you know, for what do you call it?
Dinner parties?
For dinner parties, you know, the name card. Not for, but they made them very fancy, not just little white cards, but they were, I remember one of them was a little Rococo figurine in a Rococo dress, and in front of that, you stood it up, in front of that Rococo dress was the space for the name. I mean, things were very elaborate at that time, as opposed to the really dire unemployment and inflation there was. So I don't know that that business succeeded.
But you write about how life was and then how things began to get a little dicey as Hitler's Nazis began to exert influence. And so you moved from Vienna to Berlin, to the epicenter.
From Berlin to Vienna. Okay. Basically the epicenter also to come.
And actually, you bring out an interesting point about Vienna in the book, and I'm going to forget the quote now, that the Germans were very good Nazis, but not very good anti-Semites. And the Austrians were not good Nazis, but very
marvelous anti-Semites.
And
oh, my
Hitler
Lord.
Was an Austrian. So that's
you
where
have
it
to
came
be proud
from.
Of that.
Well, but I'm saying
I know.
That's where it came from, I guess.
I don't want to go into any long discussions about Hitler's anti-Semitism and the root of it. But basically, you had the anti-Semitism in Austria, which harks back to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Don't forget, you had a lot of, you had the Poles, you had the Czechs, you had the Hungarians. The Slavic nations always were more anti-Semitic, basically, and the Austrians had learned it too, and there was always a latent anti-Semitism in Austria. Of course, you had all these rich Jewish girls that were married to the aristocrats in order to finance their crumbling estates, but the populace, basically, I suppose, must have been anti-Semitic because the way it broke out on the 11th of March of 1938 was unbelievable. I don't know whether I mentioned it in the book, but this is, I don't know whether it was a legend or the truth, but this German officer who, when he saw the excesses that the Austrian population committed on the Jewish population, he said, "We've been in power in Germany for 5 years and I've never seen anything like this." So there was a viciousness and a enjoyment of that viciousness somehow.
What I was going to lead up to a few minutes ago was the fact that you led this idyllic life, and then Hitler came to power. Things began to change. Life began to get dicey. Your father began to be aware of political pressures and the need, perhaps, to move to a lesser, to a place of more safety. And so he did. And he did this several times, because later on you moved to Prague to get away from all of this. And it brings up a question that I think a lot of people, even though we hear these stories over and over again, we just can't get in our heads why certain people, when they had the opportunity, why they didn't just get out. Why you didn't go to Spain? Why you didn't? Well, Spain would not have been a good choice.
But why, not the worst, but it would have been better than it was.
Why didn't they leave? And your book tells your own story of in which vacillation and stubbornness and denial led eventually to your imprisonment in Auschwitz and your mother's death there.
Exactly.
How? Why?
My father, God rest them both, but my father, I think, was rather under the thumb of my mother, as is shown when he left Prague without us because of her urging. Mother was a very strong person. Mother was very determined that her property was hers and nobody was going to touch that.
Yeah, because to leave, you would have had to leave everything behind.
Mm-hmm. There was the so-called, what they called the Reichsfluchtsteuer, which was the escape tax. And the escape tax, unless you had managed to get money and stuff out already, I think you could leave with 10 marks in your pocket if you declared that you were an immigrant. Mm-hmm. Mother didn't want to. And she came from Vienna, so why not go back to Vienna? And that was, of course, in hindsight, but even at that time, illogical, because Hitler was very clear about it, that he wanted Austria. And the Austrians were very clear about it, that there was already an allegiance to Germany. That we left for Prague at the time. We had one of the branches of the business in Prague. Where else to go?
And what property did she have left? Because when you moved to Prague, you were living in an apartment with three other families. A tiny, evidently, little apartment. You went from a vast apartment that your mother spent weeks redecorating and tearing walls out to a little place in Prague that you shared with two other families.
Well, not you misunderstood. The whole house was small apartments, one-room apartments. Because it was actually, our office was on the first floor of that house. Because this house basically had been done for business people to have, what do you call, small company places.
Traveling
which
business
was, yeah, yeah, which were one or two rooms with a small kitchenette and a bathroom. That's what we lived. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of other refugees that had the same place to stay.
But your father left. Your father eventually thought it's time to leave, urged your mother to come. She would not go, nor would she let you leave. Why didn't your father just grab you by the hand and take you?
Michael, I'll never know. And believe me, this is one of the things in my life that, to the rest of my life, I won't understand.
After this break, more of our 2005 conversation with Dr. Susan Czerniak-Spatz, who passed away last week. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, we're listening back to our 2005 conversation with Holocaust survivor Dr. Susan Czerniak-Spatz, who died last week at the age of 97. In our conversation, I asked her about the prisoner number she kept on her arm while other survivors had theirs removed.
Somehow or other, I felt that was part of me. And the more time passed and the less people had the tattoo, mm-hmm. people have forgotten. I mean, there was one time when somebody asked me, is that your telephone number? I mean, and so this now it has become a point of Holocaust denier tries to confront me and say it never happened.
There
I'll say I did this for my entertainment.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about your father leaving when he saw that the time was right to leave, encouraging your mother to do so. She refused to go and would not allow you to go. And it turns out, A, that there was this stubborn streak and this attachment to property, but also she was carrying on an affair with another man. Now, you do not go easy on your mother in this book. Are you angrier at her for not letting you leave with your father? Or are you angrier at her for being disloyal to your father?
The disloyalty to my father didn't bother me because this was something I knew my mother had a tendency to stray. And this was something in those circles that was nothing out of the ordinary.
Really?
No. It happened. You kept, under normal circumstances, I think every one of my parents' friends, this one
strayed.
Had an affair, that one strayed, never broke anything up. That didn't bother me. What bothered me that she, how should I say, condemned me, actually. That she condemned me to...
To Auschwitz.
To Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And possible death.
Yeah. At what point did she realize that, do you think?
I think the only time that she realized it was the moment when the train left from Theresienstadt. When I told her, I refused, I put it in the book, I said no, the first time in my life practically that I said no to a stern demand from my mother. And as the train pulled out, I said, Mother, we'll meet in Prague. You know, at that time, the Russians had already, I think, Stalingrad had happened or something. Mm-hmm. And, of course, everybody was euphorious. The war is going to end. Because I said, Mother, we'll meet Christmas at the Prashna Brana, which was one of the city monuments. And she looked out and she shook her head. I think at that point... She knew.
You're also very honest in this book about your assessment of others, about your own episodes in your own life that you could have kept silent about, but you didn't. You could have written this book without talking about a lot of the things that you went through as a young girl, the sexual escapades, even being raped. But you chose to write about these episodes.
I think it should be known because the thing was that unlike the many times that it's the stories about the SS raping the poor prisoners, which was not happening, not in Auschwitz per se, because this would have been racial miscegenation, but that the let's put it this way, when I was raped, I let myself be raped practically because I was hungry. I was promised food. And maybe I was naive enough not to expect this sort of thing. The guy was a hulking brute.
You also write, under normal circumstances, I would be ashamed of such uninhibited sleeping around, but
right.
Then nothing was normal. And they say that whole generation, that World War II generation, many times, looked at these experiences as life-affirming. In other words, death may come tomorrow, so we might as well live now. Was that part of it?
You ever heard of Eros and Thanatos? That is exactly. You didn't know what tomorrow was. There is a scene in one of the books that I use in class, in Tadeusz Borowski, which describes an actual, almost violent sexual encounter on the of two prisoners that came out of the train under a train car. Which is one of the descriptions, the minute that life is at the point of being lost, you affirm it with, that's I think the age-old, century-old contrast. You grab at life at the minute when it looks like it's gone.
When you were living in Prague in this. This is the last step toward Theresienstadt.
Yeah.
You still had a circle of friends. You were in your teenage years, and your friends went out and did things. And it seems as though you went out and did things in full view of everybody in society.
We did.
Just because you were Jewish didn't seem to make a damn bit of difference to anybody.
If you didn't look Jewish, not until the start. See, I was not in freedom, so to speak, when they originated the Star. Mm-hmm. So I in Prague until was when we were deported in 1942. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to wear the Star yet. And if you didn't look Jewish, especially if you were a woman.
Mm-hmm. It seemed like a relatively normal life in some respects.
Not some respect. Really normal. You stayed away from places that you knew could be dangerous. You, for instance, when there was this curfew, I think I mentioned it, mm-hmm. we would congregate at somebody's house who still had a fairly small, bigger apartment, and we'd play bridge all night long. Mm. I mean, we would not really venture out on party time.
But the fact that you could go out and do certain things, as long as you were careful.
Careful.
And it seemed to be that there was somewhat of an ambivalence about the Jews on the part of most of the Poles in certain areas.
Czechs,
excuse me. did that lull you into any kind of or the people who were going to be targeted eventually, lull them into some sort of false sense of security with regard to Hitler's intent?
No, I don't think so. Those of us that were there were the ones that had no way to get out. The ones that got out that knew. I mean, we all knew by that time. No, we did not know about Auschwitz.
Yeah.
We did not know. Look, he had the world so, to put it bluntly, bamboozled mm-hmm. that how the Jews are being treated nicely. And basically, Theresienstadt was established because some of the rumors had come out from the Polish ghettos of what was going on. That's why Theresienstadt was established as a false front. Mm-hmm. Because the whole world refused to believe that in the 20th century, civilized 20th century, something like that could happen. That's why little was done until it actually was forced upon them.
The Nazis themselves were particularly clever at using euphemisms for many, many things.
Oh, and how?
And that gets us to the title of your book, Protective Custody. Because that's what they said about where you were going and why you were being put there.
Michael, do you know that we were the only ones, the Jews that were destined to be gassed without questions, were the only ones that were called protective custody prisoners? Anybody else was either a political prisoner or a criminal or an asocial or a homosexual. Destined. Everyone had a name. We, who were the ones that were to be exterminated, where they got the name protective custody.
Talk about that. You talk about that in the book. Why is that? What was the difference in how they were treated or their ultimate fate?
the point was the so-called protective custody prisoners. They were the people that came on transport that were unloaded by the time Birkenau was established. I mean, I think I make it clear enough, I hope, in the book that Auschwitz per se was one of the concentration camps. And Birkenau was the extermination camp. Mm-hmm. And when you arrived, I arrived at Birkenau already in 43, in January 43, where Birkenau had just been established for about 4 months, 3 or 4 months. Protective custody prisoners arrived there by train, were unloaded, and were selected. Prisoners that came, let's say, from a concentration camp with a file in hand mm-hmm. did not go through any selections. We did. And at the selection was, you live, you die. And, of course, any woman with a child and I always stress, I don't know how the men's selection went ahead, but the women, any woman with a child, any woman under 15, or if she looked, she could be 16 if she looked frail and small, would go on the truck, and the truck went to the gas.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about your arrival at the Birkenau, but first I want to go back and talk a little bit about these euphemisms, because it seems to me that these euphemisms were deviously clever. And were they there to take the edge off for the Jews, or were they there to take the edge off for the Germans so that they wouldn't fully understand what their leaders were up to, or that they could put a good face on something and deny it?
You know, you've got a point there that I really never thought about, that it could have. Well, I always thought it was really for the broad part, I mean, the abroad, and for the Jews that they tried to lure into, into willingly going into the trains for resettlement. But there might be a point, because they were determined what they were doing was going to have no resemblance of threat. And so that's where you got the Sonderbehandlung, the special treatment, which meant immediately into the gas. That's where you got the final solution, the Endlösung, which just sort of hinted.
What does that mean?
Endlösung is final solution.
Final solution, okay.
Endlösung is final solution.
And, for instance, you and your mother and the rest of the people involved in your transport were never arrested.
No, we were never arrested. We got this. That was the absolutely fiendishly clever thing that they made the Jewish communities their forced collaborators. They forced it. You know, it's mentioned in the book. When we first in Prague, when in 1939, after the war started, we had to register and had to give up, property, furs, jewelry, et cetera, et cetera. And they had all the lists of all the Jews. And I think I mentioned it in the book. It was thanks to IBM punch cards that they had the perfect system of keeping track of property, relations, families, names, whatever. Thanks to IBM, that without the IBM punch cards, they would have not been able to structure the camps.
But you weren't arrested. You were given a little card, an invitation.
The Jewish community sent you the little cards. It was the Jewish community who was forced. The SS sent the lists to the Jewish community and said, for this week, three transports, one of elderly, one of families, one of thousands each. You arrest them. You arrange for the location where they are concentrated, where they collected. You arrange for the trains. Mm-hmm. They had to do it all. That was the fiendish. I suspect that sometimes that the accusations that the Jewish community leaders were collaborating with the Nazis was exactly that they were so fiendishly clever by forcing them to do their work.
Your middle-class background in Vienna and in Berlin sheltered you, I think I understood this from the book, that sheltered you from the bulk of a lot of the anti-Semitism that was out there.
True.
So when it came so clearly to pass that these people were so anti-Semitic that they were willing to go ahead with the final solution, did that come as a shock to the system, or did it build up over time? Did this realization unveil itself over time, or was it a sudden, oh my God, shock to the system?
I'm trying to remember, Mike, whether actually it must have come so gradual that you expected everything, mm-hmm. one step more, and then you agree with that step. You confine yourself. You are in a smaller apartment. I think it was the refusal to believe it could get much worse. And then when the deportation came to Theresienstadt, you would say, thank God, just Theresienstadt, because you had heard from people that were in the ghettos in Poland. Mm. I don't know, it must have been a refusal to think that it could get much worse.
How long were you in Theresienstadt?
From May, I think it was May 2nd or 5th of 1942 until January 28th, 1943.
So not long.
No, not long.
And when the order for transport came, how did it come? And what was, if you recall, what was you and your mother's reaction?
Packing up. I remember mother was very concerned about being in the same location with her friend so that we would all stay together. You knew you couldn't take... I remember we took some... Mother took some... She had some furs and I think some jewelry that she took to a relative of Mr. Good, a non-Jewish relative of Mr. Good. I think some of his family were married to Czechs. And I think I remember vaguely that we took some of the stuff. If you ask me today where it was and who it was, I have idea.
You could leave Theresienstadt to take these
things? No. That was in Prague before we were deported. Right. And because everything else had to stay there. Mm-hmm. And then you got yourself... And you, there was no other way to do anything because the, how should I say, the Western-oriented, sophisticated, intelligent Czechs of Prague, I cannot talk of the rest of the country, they wouldn't help you. They wouldn't hide you. No way. No way. And especially, I mean, my mother, who did not hardly spoke a word of Czech, there was no way to go. What were you to do?
But when you got the order, when you knew that you were going out to Auschwitz from Theresienstadt, what was the reaction to that? I mean, did you know where you were going? Did you know what you were heading into?
No.
It was just another
move. That time, we knew Auschwitz was a threat because nobody had come back. Nobody had been heard from, except for one postcard. Mm-hmm. And Michael, under the worst of circumstances, would you think that something like that was possible in the 20th century? That gas chambers were waiting for you?
So you didn't know precisely what was waiting, but you knew it wasn't good.
It wasn't good.
That's Dr. Susan Czerniak-Spatz, Holocaust survivor and professor emerita at UNC Charlotte. She passed away last week at the age of 97. We're revisiting our 2005 conversation with her this hour on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we're replaying a conversation from last year with Chef Vivian Howard, former host of A Chef's Life, who has a new show coming to PBS in the spring. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're spending the hour listening to our 2005 conversation with Charlotte's Dr. Susan Czerniak-Spatz, who died this past week. When the train doors finally flung open at Auschwitz-Birkenau, can you describe, do you remember what it was like, what it looked like, what it felt like, what it smelled like?
Very precise. The one thing that you mustn't forget that I was, my transport was lucky enough to be in a very old-fashioned, I would say pre-World War One train, but it was a passenger train.
As opposed to a cattle train.
As opposed to a cattle train, which was, of course, our, I would say probably our salvation, because there were, I mean, they were gruesome looking, but there were, was a bathroom at each end of those trains. There were the guards, of course, but there were seats, there were benches, compartments with benches. So it wasn't this inhuman cattle train with the buckets in the middle. Mm-hmm. So basically, I suppose we were in better shape physically than most of those people. Yeah. And so that's when we got out. We were very much aware of our surroundings. It was not just this air and movement, but what's going on. And the first thing that hit you, was actually, as they chased you out and throw your luggage, etc., was a stink. It was a smell that was absolutely indescribable. It was nauseating, sweetish, nauseating. You couldn't identify it. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing it ever reminded me of later as I thought about it. When I was little, and little, I don't know, under normal circumstances, we used to buy chickens from the market fresh. And after they kill them, they had to be plucked, and they used to be singed. The skin feathers, I guess. Oh, that was somehow resembling that smell, and that was a repulsive smell.
Was it day? Was it night?
It was night.
It was night.
It was night. During the time when I arrived, most of the transports came at night. I think it was calculated so that the rest of the camp would not see or hear. But during the Hungarian transports in 44, in the summer of 44, when they had 4 and 5 and 6 transports a day, they came all day long. They didn't mind at that time anymore who saw what. But it was night, and you came out, and at the end of the train, towards where the engine would be, there was this flame. It was one chimney. Flame shooting out, and you could see the black smoke roiling ahead of those flames. And you couldn't figure out what was burning there that made that smell, because the smell had to come from there. Mm-hmm. That was the first impression. And then, of course, was this lineup in row of 5, and you saw on the side that ambulance, the very famous ambulance. Every writer that describes arrivals in Birkenau will tell you about that ambulance. Because that was one of these typical psychological tricks of the Germans. As I mentioned, they hated Freud and they thought it was a Jewish science and it was a bunch of bunk, but they used it. Yeah. There was that ambulance with the big red cross on the hood, the big red cross on the door, nice gray, field gray ambulance. And anybody who, in the 20th century, what does the Red Cross represent? Security.
Help. Yeah, security.
Help. International goodwill. Uh-huh. That thing never saw a corpse or a sick person inside as long as it was there. It brought the tins of Cyclone B to the gas chamber, which was in the direction of those flames, and brought the empty tins back. That was all it was there for. And, of course, there's always a double used for the German. One was the psychological, the other one was the pragmatic one. And there, the pragmatic one was the transportation. The psychological one was keep the animals quiet.
Mm-hmm. Lull them into a false sense of security.
Right.
And then they divided you. This is where you lost track of your mother, I think. Is it not? Or is it
Don't forget. Mother left Theresienstadt. I stayed in Theresienstadt. Remember?
Right. Yes. So you arrive in Birkenau
alone,
and they process you, and you are shown to your barracks, your new living quarters. You learn some things very quickly about how to survive in that environment, because that was a pestilent, disgusting, horrible place.
You had to make up your mind very quickly. Did you want to live or did you want to die?
Mm-hmm.
It was a very conscious decision. Because if you wanted to give in, dying was no art in Birkenau. Absolutely no art.
Easy to do.
Living was the heroism.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you see, all values in that camp were upside down. The values of normal life didn't count. Simply didn't count. Lawrence Langer wrote a book about that once and said that the outside world, one of the reasons that the outside world had such a hard time understanding what Birkenau represented or existence in Birkenau represented was the fact that the normal Western civilization values didn't count.
Mm-hmm. So where did that come from in you? Obviously, you made a decision to live, and you lived by you were smart. And you learned quickly, and you had allies along the way, because people did help each other.
Yes,
in the
women
camp.
Did. Now, see, again, I do not know about the men's camp. Men's camp, I only know of what I read.
But you learned quickly to get a top bunk, if you could.
That was the first lesson, and that was important.
Why?
Well, this gets a little bit disgusting, because the the so-called the three rows. I mean, if anybody has ever seen the plan of Birkenau, there were 20. Let me see, 15, I think, 15 stone barracks on one side, and 15 stone barracks or more, maybe, on the other side, which were the prefab, the high prefab, like horse stables, mm-hmm. which were the Aryan side. The stone barracks were the Jewish side. And the in the women's camp that we came in, there was Birkenau A was the women's camp when I came in. Later on, A and B were combined to be all of the women's camp. And in A, there were blocks 1, 2, and 3 were the new arrival blocks. And for those three blocks, there was one latrine. And each one of those blocks, supposedly destined for about 300 people at the time, would hold about 500 to 600 at a time, women. And at night, of course, you could not go to the latrine. You were forbidden to go out. The only one that was entitled to go out was the person, the so-called night guard, which was one of the prisoners. That it was a very desirable job, of course, to be the night guard, to be in charge of the buckets in front of the block. And the prisoners would come out to use the buckets. And the night guard was the one that was entitled to carry the buckets to the latrine when they got too full. And if you came out and those buckets looked a little too full and she didn't feel like trapping back there with the buckets, she had a nice stout stick and she'd hit you on over the back, wherever it hit, get back. And then what were you supposed to do? Mm-hmm. So you had your famous, infamous bowl, and you used that bowl.
Yeah, that bowl that gave you, that was your bowl for everything.
That was your utensil.
Yeah. You also did something very early on in your stay there that could have cost you your life, but ended up probably saving your life. You stepped forward to this German soldier and volunteered information about yourself.
He was an officer.
Okay.
But see, this was an almost instinctive thing in Theresienstadt. You wanted a job, you went to the authorities and asked for a job. After you had gone through in Theresienstadt, it was a so-called initiation 30 days of working on an outside work. So that was, and you wanted a job, you asked for a job. So I didn't, what did I know about the routines in Birkenau? So as we were standing ready to march out, and I was standing, here was the road, here was the side of the road, here was the...
And to march out, you were marching out
marching
to work
out to
in
work,
the field.
To the outside field work. And we were all in rows of five, and I stood at the, well... It's hard to explain. I was standing so that the SS was standing right next to me, mm-hmm. the doctor and the work assignment commander. And I was just, to me, it was natural. I stepped out and very politely stood at attention and said, please, I'd like to report. I am an office worker. I would like to ask for a job. And the guy looked at me and then he started laughing. And wrote my number down. And as I stepped back into the line, somebody must be behind me or before me that had been there, maybe it's a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and they said, "You're crazy? My God, you're lucky that he didn't take you out." And somehow or other, this man remembered me through two more incidents of work assignment in the 2 years that I was there.
Because you got to work indoors, which was the desirable, obviously.
Not only desirable, but that was the only way to survive.
Life-saving, yeah.
Mike, if anybody who's alive today had either an administrative job or a job in one of the commandos that worked inside, mm-hmm. indoors, you did not survive on the outside. Primo Levi, if you ever get a chance to read Primo Levi's book, the Survival at Auschwitz, there's a chapter called The Drowned and the Saved. And the drowned were the ones that quietly followed every direction, stayed on the outside commandos, and eventually, in rather short time, ended up in the gas. And the saved were the ones that were determined to live and found ways and learned ways to live and made connections. And the one thing, I don't know about the man's camp, but women networked.
Did you know, were you consciously aware of what you were doing, or was it just instinctive in terms of networking and finding ways to survive and keeping your ears open and taking advantages and taking chances here and knowing when to hold back there? Was it instinctive, or did you know what you were doing?
I think the first two times, I mean, the first time that I came into the so-called main administration building and worked there and then was kicked out after about 2 months or so, that's when I must have started consciously to look for survival, because by that time I knew what it was.
Because, you know, we've seen these movies about this. We've seen television shows about this, but these cannot communicate the truth. I mean, they do a job of showing you what it might have been like, but unless you're there and you're wearing the same clothes they gave you a year or two later that they gave you when you walked in, if you're lucky enough to be alive a year or two later.
A year or two? Eight months or two.
Okay. But you've been out working, it's been cold, it's been hot, it's been raining, you've been standing in lineups for hours on end, they don't let you shower, they don't wash the clothes, they're stiff. Lice, fleas,
yes. Bed bugs.
How do you survive that? And at least when you're inside, when you're working in the office, they make you clean. Because they don't want to be around that.
Exactly. And that, after having been in the so-called Stabsgebäude, in the main administration, after I was kicked out from there, I knew to survive you had to be in that kind of surrounding. And as soon as I came back to Birkenau, I tried to find out as soon as possible if this girl that had promised me to talk to her sister had talked to her sister who was a runner in Birkenau to make that connection. I did make that connection really by pure coincidence, but when I came back into Birkenau, the first thing I did was to find a way to connect to the block leader. And luckily enough, the one that in block three, the girl by the name of Ilka Grün, I did connect with her due to the mere fact that I spoke French and German, and she didn't speak too good German and not very good French, and there were quite a few French girls in the block. And I helped her with interpreting.
Right.
And see, this was the thing, just like you said, I knew in order to survive, I had to find connections. Ilka Grün was the first one. And she was the one that let me stay in the block for this one day with the one aspirin and one vitamin C.
You were sick for a while.
And
could have meant your death.
Could have been at that point that I described it in there. Yeah. I think that was the closest to death I ever got. But
she gave you
one
extra
vitamin
day.
C, one aspirin, and one day before she sent me to block 27, which was your death sentence.
That's Dr. Susan Cherniak-Spatz in a conversation from 2005 after the publication of her memoir, Protective Custody. It was one of several visits Dr. Cherniak-Spatz made to this program. She died this past week at the age of 97. Here's how her son-in-law remembers her. Not only was she an amazing woman who made it through the Holocaust by sheer will, incredible intelligence, and dare I say, cunning. As a side note, he points out the four languages she spoke, which made her valuable to her captors. He goes on to say, Susan was one of the most powerful, determined, cultured people I'd ever met. She was a strong and powerful presence in our family, the matriarch, queen. She was irascible, opinionated, but always loving. She was also intellectually curious, politically concerned, and a great lover of classical music and opera. Throughout her long life, Susan expressed pride in her religion, her family, and her people. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.